Richards, and Rachel Scoburn will talk about it. Welcome in.
I'm pausing slightly so that other people have a bit of a chance to come in. And besides, I do need at some point to put the sugar in my tea. So I'm discovering the complexities of this slanted surface here. So, what is free software? Free software is software that respects the freedom of the user. The typical software that you will find, non-free software, keeps users divided and helpless. It's distributed as part of a scheme to keep users divided and helpless. Divided because each user is forbidden to share with anyone else. And helpless because none of these users can change the software or even independently determine what it does. By contrast, free software encourages cooperation and empowers the user, all by respecting people's freedom to control their software and to share with each other. But I should be more specific. Just saying respect people's freedom could mean so many different things. But when we talk of free software, there's a very specific meaning of freedom that we're talking about. A program is free software for you, a particular user, if you have these four essential freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you see fit. Freedom one is the freedom to help yourself, the freedom to study the source code and then change it to do what you want. Freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor, the freedom to make copies and distribute them to others. And freedom three is the freedom to help build your community, the freedom to publish a modified version so that others can get the benefit of your contribution. All four of these freedoms are essential. They're not levels of freedom, they are four different freedoms, all of which we must have. But why these particular freedoms? Why are these the essential freedoms for a person who uses software? Freedom two is essential for a specific ethical reason, a fundamental reason, so that you can be a decent person and live an upright life. You see, freedom two is the freedom to share, the freedom to redistribute copies of the program, the freedom to help your neighbor. If you use a program that does not let you have freedom two, that means you're in a situation where at any moment you could find yourself in a moral dilemma. Whenever some person says to you, "Could I have a copy of that program?" at that point you find yourself forced to choose between two evils. One evil is to make a copy of this program for him and violate the license. And the other evil is to refuse to give him a copy and comply with the license. So once you're in this situation, you should choose the lesser of the two evils, which is to make a copy for him and violate the license. This is the lesser evil because the one that you're doing wrong to is somebody who has done a much bigger wrong and deserves it. Whoever tried deliberately to divide you from all your neighbors, from everyone in the world, is doing something extremely wrong. So that's what you should do once you're in that situation. But although that's the lesser of the two evils, that doesn't mean it's good. because you are, after all, making one more copy of a non-free program. And the only thing in software that's worse than an unauthorized copy of a proprietary program is an authorized copy of the proprietary program. With the authorized copy, it has all the same disadvantages, and in addition, the perpetrator of the scheme is probably getting paid. So, if you find yourself in that situation, you should choose the lesser of the two evils. But having understood this, what you should really do is avoid taking a step onto the pathway that leads to the moral dilemma. The way you can avoid both evils. If you don't have that non-free program, this can't happen to you. So the right thing to do is refuse to use it and refuse to have it yourself. That way, you won't find yourself in a moral dilemma. Once John Perry Barlow was giving a speech, and he asked the people in the audience, raise your hand if you have no unauthorized copies of software. And only one person in the audience raised his hand. And when Barlow saw it was me, he said, oh, of course, you. All my copies are authorized because they're all free software. If someone offers me a program, no matter how attractive it is, but I have to promise I won't share it with you, I will say no. That's my ethical commitment. The most essential resource of any society is the spirit of goodwill, the spirit of helping your neighbor. This is not a physical resource, it's a psychosocial resource, but that doesn't make it any less important. This resource makes the difference between a livable society and a dog-eat-dog jungle. It's not by coincidence that the world's major religions have been promoting this spirit of goodwill for thousands of years, because even a little increase in people's readiness to help their neighbors makes life better for everyone. So what does it mean when powerful social institutions say that it's wrong to share with your neighbor? What are they doing? They're poisoning this essential resource, something that no society can afford. And what does it mean when they say that if you share with your neighbor, you're a pirate? They're equating helping your neighbor with attacking ships. And this is not just wrong, it's backwards. Because attacking ships is very, very wrong. But helping your neighbor is admirable and is to be encouraged. And what does it mean when they create harsh punishments, as they're trying to do in Europe now, for people who share with their neighbors? How much fear is it going to take before people are too scared ever to help their neighbors? Do you want your society to suffer this campaign of terror? Terror campaign is the only word for this. In Argentina and in Germany already, the developers of proprietary software have threatened people with being raped in prison for having unauthorized copies of proprietary software. This terror campaign must be ended. That's the reason why freedom two is essential. Freedom number two is the freedom to help your neighbor, the freedom to make copies and distribute them to others. Freedom zero serves a completely different purpose. Freedom zero is necessary so you can have control of your own computer. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program however you wish, for whatever purpose you wish. Now, most programs actually do let you have this freedom, but there are exceptions, programs that restrict when you can use them, how much you can use them, by who it can be used on your computer, and so on. And those are particularly restrictive programs. So freedom zero is rather obvious. We must be free to run the program. But freedom zero is not enough, because that's only the freedom to do whatever the developer chose. You're hardly in control of your own computer if all you can do is tell it to start doing what someone else decided for you. So you need freedom one, which is the freedom to help yourself, the freedom to study the source code and then change it to do what you want. Without freedom zero, without freedom one, you can't even tell what the program is doing. The developer asks you to take it on faith. But sometimes what they tell you is not the whole story. Many proprietary programs contain malicious features, features designed to spy on the user, interfere with the user, impose on the user, or cause trouble for the user. For instance, spyware is quite common. Many proprietary programs are designed to spy on the user. One rather widely used example of spyware is Windows XP. If you search your own files for a word, it sends a message to Microsoft saying what word you're searching for. And when it asks for an upgrade, it describes all the software installed on your disk. These are two examples of spyware features that we know about. There may be others that we don't. Windows is not alone in this. Windows Media Player is also spyware. Whatever the user looks at, because I hope the user is not you, whatever the user looks at with Windows Media Player, it says to Microsoft exactly what the user is doing. But please don't think that Microsoft is the only proprietary software developer that would do such a thing. RealPlayer also is spyware in exactly the same way, and so is the TiVo. People applauded the TiVo because it contains a lot of free software, but it also contains non-free software, and it has spyware. Spying is not the only thing that they do. Some programs have the functionality of refusing to function. This is also known as DRM, or Digital Restrictions Management, where the program says, you can't look at that file, you can't copy lines from that file, you can't tell me to read this file aloud, or various other things. So, you'll find, therefore, that the developers of non-free software are often deliberately trying to make the program bad for you, because that serves their other interests. Sometimes non-free programs will change the configuration of your computer. For instance, set it up to display ads. And they figure you won't know how to undo what they did. And sometimes they even have backdoors. For instance, Windows XP has a backdoor. When it asks for an upgrade, it tells Microsoft who you are. So they could give you, or the user, because I hope you're not a user of this. They could give the user an upgrade designed specifically for him. Perhaps one that has a few secret accounts that they can log in on, or perhaps one that doesn't function at all. They might do this for the CIA when they're asked, who knows? Now, that's the back door that Microsoft deliberately put in. In January, I was in India, and they told me that some programmers working on Windows XP had been arrested and accused of working for Al-Qaeda, putting in a back door that Microsoft wasn't supposed to know about. Well, that attempt apparently has failed. Were there others that succeeded? There's no way we can tell. So the developers of non-free software say, trust me, and we know that many of them are not trustworthy. However, there are also developers of non-free software who sincerely try to make the program do what the user would like. However, they are all human. They all make mistakes. They all design features that they think users will like, but users don't. They all make errors in writing the code. And when they do that, you're helpless too. There's nothing you can do to correct their mistakes. We free software developers are also human. We also make mistakes. I may develop features that you won't like. I may write bugs when I'm writing code. The difference is that we free software developers do not keep you helpless. We do not keep you divided and powerless. Because you're not a prisoner of our mistakes. Since you can get the source code for our software, if you don't like what we did, you can change it. And there is the difference. We understand that we're human, that we can't always do what you want, that sometimes you won't agree with us. And we respect your right to make the software do what you like. But freedom one is not enough. Freedom one is the freedom to study the code and change it personally. Why is this not enough? Well, first of all, there are millions of computer users who don't know how to program, or who only know a little how to program, and it wouldn't be feasible for them to make the changes they want directly, personally. But even for us programmers, freedom one is not enough, because there's so much software. There's so much free software. Nobody has time to master it all and personally make all the changes that he wants. The only way we can really have control of our computers is to do it jointly, to work together. And for that, we need freedom three, the freedom to publish a modified version. This is the freedom that allows the whole community, or a large part of the community that share common desires, to benefit from the changes that are made by a few. So, if I were foolish enough to put a spyware feature into my free software, I might not tell people. So there would be maybe then millions of users using a program which does something they don't like. But sooner or later, somebody's going to find it by looking at the source code and fix it, and then change and publish this modified version and announce what they've found. And then everybody's going to switch. They'll all use his version. So here you'd have millions of people who all got the benefit, all got the change they wanted, but only one of them had to do it. And this is because of Freedom 3. So these millions of people could include many people who don't know how to program, but they still get the benefit of the fact that other people in their community have the freedom to change the software and share it. Of course, since I know this would happen, I wouldn't dare try it. I want you to use my version. If there's anything I can anticipate that a lot of users won't like, I'm not going to do it, because I know that they're not helpless. I don't have them under my power. I don't have them in a firm grip. If they don't like my version, they'll have another version, and it'll do what they want, and they won't use mine anymore. So I just have to try to please the users as best I can. But since nobody can anticipate always what other people are going to like, it's very important that even though I'm trying my best, you're still not dependent on me. Others can make improvements, can go beyond what I thought of, and make things better. Suppose there are a million users who would like a certain change in a certain free program. Well, just by luck, I'd expect there would be 10,000 who know how to program, if we're talking about advanced countries. And so sooner or later, 10 of them will get together and make this change. Well, it may not require 10, maybe just one, but it could be 1 or 10. Anyway, they'll publish their modified version, and all of these million people will switch to it, because they see the announcement of it, and they say, I'd like that. So a million or so people who don't know how to program are getting what they wanted. And there may be another million who prefer the original version. Well, then they can all get what they want. Suppose there are 1,000 people who would like a certain change, and none of them knows how to program. Some of them can start talking about it and ask, who else shares our preference? And so these 1,000 people would start talking to each other and form an organization. And this organization could collect money from each of them. So if each of them contributes $100, then they'll have $100,000 in the organization, Well, that would be enough to pay two or three programmers for a year. There are people who would really love to be able to work on free software and would be glad to be paid less than they can make elsewhere. So that's enough for a lot of changes. So this, in this way, users, even when all the users who want to change are non-programmers, they can still take advantage of this freedom to get what they want. And when they are looking for the programmers to hire, because of course to get the change made they have to hire programmers, they can go to one programming company and say, how much will you charge to do this job and when can you have it done? And if they're not entirely happy with the answer, they can go to another programming company and say, what will you charge? When can you have it done? Which illustrates that free software implies a free market for all kinds of support and services. Anyone who wishes to can study the source code and begin to offer support for the program. By contrast, with proprietary software, support is usually a monopoly because only the developer has the source code, so only the developer can make any change. If you want any change, you must go to the developer. You're dealing with a monopoly. And that's why the support for proprietary software is usually so bad. Some developers will say, pay us and we'll listen to you when you report the problem. And if you do that, they'll say, thank you very much. In 6 months there will be an upgrade. Buy the upgrade and you'll see if we fix this bug and you'll see what new bugs we have in store for you. But free software means a free market for support, which means that those who value support and are willing to pay for it can in general expect better support for free software. And one interesting paradoxical consequence of this is that a choice of proprietary programs is a choice between monopolies. If you choose this proprietary program, which I hope you won't, then support for it afterwards will be a monopoly. If you choose this proprietary program, which you shouldn't, then support for it will be this monopoly. And if you choose this proprietary program, and please don't, then support for it will be this monopoly. So it's a choice between monopolies. And this illustrates the fact that it's a mistake to equate freedom with having a choice between a few discrete options. Freedom is not just the freedom to make some choice. Freedom is having control of your life. The choice between proprietary programs is being able to choose your master. Freedom is not having a master. So, I've explained why these four freedoms are essential. If you, the user, have all four of these freedoms, freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish, freedom one, the freedom to help yourself, which is the freedom to study the source code and change it as you wish, freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor, the freedom to distribute copies to others. And freedom three is the freedom to help build your community, the freedom to publish a modified version so that others can get the benefit of your improvements. If you have all four of these freedoms, then the program is free software for you. Why do I define it in that complicated way? Why do I say it's free software for you if you have these freedoms? The reason is, in some cases, a program can be free software for some users and not others. The biggest example of this that I know of is the X window system. It was released by its developers at MIT under a license that gave the users all four of these freedoms. So it was free software for them, for those who got the MIT version. But among those who got this version were various computer companies that distributed Unix systems. They took the sources of X, changed it a little to run on their platform, compiled it into binaries, and put these binaries into their Unix systems, and distributed just the binaries under the same non-disclosure agreement as the rest of Unix. Which means that for all the people who got those versions of X, the same code was non-free for them. It was just as non-free as Unix was. Well, I had seen instances of this when I started developing GNU, and I didn't want that to happen with my software, so I developed a technique to prevent it, a technique that I call copyleft. In copyleft, we use copyright law, but we use it for the opposite of its usual purpose. Usually, copyright law is used to deny users these freedoms. With copyleft, we use it instead to guarantee all users these freedoms, to defend the user's freedom. Here's how it works. We put on first a copyright notice, reminding people that the program is copyrighted, which by default means that it's forbidden to copy or modify or distribute the program. But then we say, you are authorized to copy this program. You're authorized to distribute copies. You're authorized to modify it. You're authorized to publish modified versions. But there is a condition, and the condition is the reason we go to all this trouble. The condition says that any version of this program that you distribute, anything that includes any substantial part of this program, must, as a whole, be available to its users as source code and must be distributed under these same conditions. No more and no less. And what this means is that anybody who gets a copy from you must get from you the same freedoms that you got from us. In other words, we defend the freedom of every user by saying that nobody is allowed to put himself in the middle and strip away the freedom and pass along the code without the freedom. That makes sure that when the code reaches you, it comes with the same freedoms that it's supposed to have. The specific license that I wrote to implement this general idea of copyleft is called the GNU General Public License. A copyleft license designed so that you can drop it into the programs that you write easily and thus copyleft them. Now, in the early 80s, I had reached the conclusion that software users are morally entitled to these four freedoms. They should always have the freedom to run, change, study, change, and redistribute the software that they use. But the actual situation in the world was completely different. It was almost the exact opposite. It was impossible to use a computer in freedom. Once you get a computer, in order for it to do anything for you, you need an operating system. And at the time, all the operating systems were proprietary. In fact, you had to sign a non-disclosure agreement betraying the rest of society, promising not to share with anybody, merely to get the executables, and the source code was not available at all. In fiction, at least, when people join criminal gangs, they are required to commit a horrible crime as a sort of initiation rite, so that they're now forced to cast their lot with the gang, because otherwise they'd get in too much trouble. Whether it was intentional or not, that's how things worked for computer use in the early 80s, in fact, all the 80s. The first thing you had to do was sign this betrayal, and from that point on, how could you ever listen to your conscience again? So the only way to change the situation was to have some operating system that people could use in freedom. And once I realized that, then I, being an operating system developer by profession, realized that I had exactly the skills necessary to try to change this situation. If I wrote another operating system and said everyone is free to share it, this would give everyone a way out of the moral dilemma that they were put into by the licenses of the operating systems of the time. So I concluded I had been elected by circumstances to do this job. I had the skills necessary to do it. I was aware of the problem, and no one else was paying attention. So it was unlikely that anyone else would do it if I did not. I realized this was probably the most important thing I'd ever have a chance to try to do in my entire life. So I had to do it. It's as if you see someone drowning, and you know how to swim, and it's not Bush or Kerry, then you have a duty to save that person. Well, not quite. I suppose you shouldn't save Ashcroft or Rumsfeld either. So, I decided to develop a free software operating system. Well, the next question was, technically, what kind of system should it be? Well, I didn't know what kind of computers would be popular in 5 or 10 years, so I decided it had better be a portable system. And I only knew of one successful portable operating system, that was Unix. So I decided to follow the design of Unix. That way I'd have a good chance of making a system that really would be portable. Then I further thought that I should make it compatible with Unix. After all, there were a lot of people already using Unix, and users don't like incompatible changes. So if I had made my own system design totally with all my favorite features, it would have been incompatible, and then most of the users would have said, it's very nice, but we've already trained people to use Unix and written software for Unix. It would be too much work to switch, so no thanks. At that point, I could have said, I offered them freedom, they didn't take it, it's their fault. But I wanted to do more than just make an excuse. I wanted to build a community that would have people living in it, living in freedom. And to do that, I had to develop a system that people would use. Making it compatible with an existing popular system was a good way to help that. So I decided to make the system compatible with Unix, upward compatible. It was okay to add more features, but the features people were used to had better keep working. Well, Unix consists of many components that work together through interfaces more or less documented. So, and the users use these same interfaces. So the only way to be compatible is to keep the same interfaces, which means replacing each component one by one. Which means that the initial design decisions were already made. How convenient. The only thing I needed in order to start the project was a name. Now, in my community, we always enjoy finding funny names for programs. So, and we had a custom that when you were writing a program that was similar to an existing program, you could give your program a name that was a recursive acronym saying that it is not the other program. So for instance, there were, in the 60s and 70s, there were many TECO text editors, and most of them were called something or other TECO. But one clever hacker called his program TINT, for TINT is not TECO. And we were very amused by that. So in 1975, I developed the first extensible programmable Emacs text editor. And there were many imitations, many of whom called something or other Emacs, but there was also Fine, for Fine is not Emacs, and Sign, for Sign is not Emacs, and Ina, for Ina is not Emacs, and Mince, for Mince is not complete Emacs. And Ina was mostly rewritten, and version 2 was called Zwei, or Zwei was Ina initially. So, you can have lots of fun with recursive acronyms. I looked for a recursive acronym for something is not Unix, but all the obvious four-letter possibilities were no good because they had no other meaning. If it doesn't have another meaning, it's not funny. I thought, what can I do? Well, maybe I could make a contraction. I could make a three-letter recursive acronym. So I started trying letters. ANU, BNU, KNU, DNU, ENU, FNU, GNU. Well, GNU is the funniest word in the English language. So that had to be it. Now, why is this word so funny? Well, according to the dictionary, it's pronounced GNU. So people started asking each other, hey, what's GNU? Instead of, hey, what's new? And then there, but that started getting used for lots of jokes. And there's even a funny song that's based on this word and starts from there. So with so much humor associated with the word, it was the best possible name for anything. However, when it's the name of this operating system, please don't follow the dictionary. Please pronounce it GNU. If you talk about the new operating system, you'll get people confused. We've been working on it for over 20 years now, so it's not new anymore. But it still is and always will be GNU, no matter how many people call it Linux by mistake. So during the 80s, we were developing these various pieces aiming for a complete operating system. And by the early 90s, it was almost done. We had all of the necessary components except one, the kernel. And we started working on a kernel, but it took a long time to get it to work at all. And someone else wrote a kernel and got it to work very soon. Well, worked minimally, but that was enough to start, and that was in less than a year. That was Linus Torvalds, a Finnish college student, and he gave his kernel the name Linux. Initially, Linux was not free software, but he had heard me give a speech, I believe, in Finland, and so he re-released it in 1992 under the GNU GPL. So at that point, it was free software. And so the combination of GNU and Linux made a complete system, the GNU/Linux system. And so by filling the last gap in GNU, he took the step that carried us across the finish line. And so for the first time, it was possible to get a modern personal computer and run it using free software without betraying your neighbors, without being subjugated. And that, in fact, was the goal we had initially set out to achieve. Of course, there was plenty more to do to go from there into having an operating system that everyone would like to use and does every job. We're still working on that, and we still have work to do. But at least we had reached a point where those who were really determined to live in freedom could do so. And thus, the kernel Linux was an important contribution to the free software community. However, at the same time, people got confused and started thinking that the whole system was Linux and that it had all been started by Linus Torvalds, which is not correct. So I ask you please to call the system GNU/Linux and give the principal developers, the ones who really started this, a share of the credit, an equal share. I think that we're entitled to that much. Now, sometimes people say to me, though, that they think I shouldn't say this. They say it looks bad to ask for credit, which is true. So they say that it would be better if when people call the system Linux, I simply keep quiet and smile to myself and take pride in a job well done. Well, that would be very wise advice if it were true that the job is done. It would also be wise advice if there were nothing at stake here except getting credit for the thousands of people who have contributed to GNU development since 1984. But there's much more at stake here. You see, the names GNU and Linux are associated with two different philosophies. The name GNU is associated with the philosophy of freedom that I have been explaining today, with the free software movement, with the determination to live in freedom and to work for it for as long as it takes. Our goal is the liberation of cyberspace and everyone in it. Whereas Linux is associated with a very different philosophy, the philosophy that the most important thing is to have powerful, reliable software, and it doesn't matter if you have to sign away your freedom to get it. Well, that philosophy is not going to inspire people to fight for freedom, because it doesn't say that freedom is the important thing. And history shows us that people who don't fight for their freedom tend to lose it. Freedom doesn't protect itself automatically. You have to defend it. But in order to defend it, first you have to value it. And in order to value it, first you have to recognize it. And in our community, there are a lot of people talking about how great the software is, but not that many talking about what the freedom is. So most of the users of free software don't even know what freedom they have. If people don't recognize the freedom, then they're likely to lose it because they let it slip through their fingers because they don't know what they're losing. There are always people who will offer you something attractive in exchange for your freedom. Look at what's happened to the United States in recent years. It was the victim of a terrible attack by its own leaders against its freedom. And only a fraction of Americans realize how important this was. So, you can give people freedom for a moment using their computers by giving them an operating system of completely free software. But if you don't teach them to recognize what this freedom is and to value it, they won't have it for long. Because someone will come along and say, here's a nice add-on package you could install. And your computer will do more. And won't say, this is in exchange for your freedom, but that will be the truth. They might offer a Java interpreter. They might offer a Flash player. They might offer all sorts of various things. I've mentioned two of the most common ones. And people, if people haven't learned to appreciate freedom, they won't see any reason to say no. So if we want to build a community where we have freedom, and we'll continue to have freedom, the most important thing we have to do in the long term is to talk about freedom, explain the value of freedom, explain why non-free software tramples your freedom. We have taught the computers of users of the world to insist on freedom for themselves and for everyone else. And then our freedom will be secure. I hope that you will help me in this activity. So, before I take questions and then offer for sale some Free Software Foundation pins and key rings and hand out some stickers, I would like to close by presenting my alter ego. You see, sometimes people accuse me of having a holier-than-thou attitude. I think that that's not actually true. I don't criticize or look down on people just because they're not fighting as strongly as I am for free software. If they're helping, I thank them for their help. I may suggest ways they could fight more effectively and more strongly, but I still appreciate whatever they do. However, it's true that I have a holy attitude because I'm a saint. I'm supposed to be holy. Saint Ignatius of the Church of Emacs. I bless your computer, my child. Emacs started out as a text editor, which became a way of life for many users, and eventually also became a religion. We even have a great schism between two rival versions of Emacs. And now we also have saints, fortunately no gods. To be a member of the Church of Emacs, you must recite the Confession of the Faith. You must say, there is no system but GNU, and Linux is one of its kernels. The Church of Emacs has certain advantages compared with other churches I won't name. For instance, to be a saint in the Church of Emacs does not require celibacy. So if you've been searching all your life for a church in which to be holy, you might consider ours. But it does require living a life of moral purity. You must exorcise the evil proprietary operating systems that possess any or all of the computers under your direct practical control, and then install a wholly free operating system, where holy can be spelled in more than one way, and then only install free software on top of that. If you make this vow and live by it, then you too will be a saint, and you too may eventually have a halo, if you can find one, because they don't make them anymore. Sometimes people ask me if it's a sin in the Church of VI, in the Church of Emacs, to use the editor VI. Now, it's true that VI is the editor of the beast. But using a free version of VI is not a sin, it's a penance. Now, sometimes people ask me if my halo is really an old computer disk. This is no computer disk, this is my halo. But it was a computer disk in a previous existence. So thank you, and now I will take questions. Fields, they are media. I believe that the same conclusions apply to all kinds of works that serve a practical purpose that you use to do something. For these works include software, recipes, reference works such as dictionaries and encyclopedias, and educational and training works, you know, textbooks and manuals. These things should all be free. I would not reach the same conclusions about works that serve other purposes. I don't think that they all have to be free, but I would say that for any kind of published work, everyone must always have the freedom to non-commercially redistribute verbatim copies. That's the minimum freedom that everyone must always have. Could you try to speak with a bit less of an accent?
Sorry.
It's hard to understand your words.
I'll try. I won't put on an American accent. I wonder if, given that software really means games, as opposed to hardware, original meaning, is non-free software manufactured to manufacture products?
It's easy for the developers to change. It's not inherently hard to change, it's just that the developer is keeping you helpless.
Isn't it just a manufactured product that you should develop?
No, because you see, with physical objects, you are free to change them, it's just hard. Nobody is deliberately keeping you helpless, and nobody is keeping people divided either. Can't stop you. They have no right to stop you.
We're not buying OTIF anymore. We're buying licenses to
That's not in general true. They claim that that is true of software, and only software. When you buy a car or a shower or whatever, you are buying the object. And when you buy a copy of free software, you are buying it. You really own your copy. So free software respects property rights. The non-free software, they often claim, indeed, not always, but often do claim that you can't own a copy. So they do not respect people's property rights for anyone except themselves. There's a person over there.
Yes, I mean, for some of the Microsoft, the one set of the deal is a virus because it other.
But that's not true.
Do you think this is a compliment or an insult?
Well, it was an insult, but it's false. It's a very clear way of describing a mistaken idea. The GPL doesn't do that. The GPL doesn't spread through proximity. It spreads only when you copy some code into your program. So rather than comparing it to a virus, you should compare it to a spider plant. You know, if you cut off a piece of a spider plant and plant it over there, okay, then now there'll be a spider plant there. But you don't have to do that. It's entirely under your control.
But now you assume all intelligent people. I've seen copies of free software in proprietary software.
Well, the point is, they did look. Well, you know, you're fudging things. They copied the code. It didn't spread of its own accord. So don't misrepresent things. They did this. Now, sure, people can do things that are stupid. But the point is, they did it. It didn't just, the code didn't do this to them. Some of the Creative Commons licenses are free licenses, most of them are not. However, they're mainly intended for art and entertainment, and so they're okay for that. You shouldn't use them for software or for documentation and reference works. They're not. That's not what they're for.
Can you explain a little more about what they were not using, for example?
The Flash Player is non-free software. Its source code is not available, and therefore it's a problem. And to solve that problem, we should not use it. So if you look at a website that has Flash on it, contact them and say, please replace this Flash. It's not nice to make people use a non-free program in order to see your site.
For some time now, the Free Software Foundation has been working on version 3 of the GPL license.
That's one thing we want to do, but we haven't figured out just what we should do.
Is that exactly the reason?
That and a couple of other things. What to do about treacherous computing. There are a couple of problems we haven't solved yet. And also, precisely how we have an idea for how to deal with the issue of somebody who makes a modified version and runs it on his web server but never publishes it. Now, the right to make changes and use them privately is something that we defend. We're not going to require people to publish all their changed versions. But when you're using the modified version publicly like that, that's not private anymore. So in that case, we're looking for a way that optionally a program can require that modified versions used publicly be made available to its user, to their users. No, they will still be incompatible. The Apache license, if I remember right, has conditions that we think are just, that we don't want to let into GPL-covered software. How you do with promises not to use the trademarked names of the program. Now, trademark will exist. If these names are trademarks, that has certain consequences. But trademark law only covers certain kinds of use of the name. And the conditions in that license go further, and that causes a practical problem, we're afraid, and we don't want to go that far.
One more question?
One more question. Okay, you with your hand.
I would like to comment on software pages, Kevin.
You'd like me what?
Comment on software pages, Kevin.
Well, software idea patents are dangerous to software developers. Because when you write a large program, you're combining thousands of ideas, and the program can be covered by hundreds of different patents at once. So how is anyone supposed to develop software under such circumstances? For instance, Linux, the kernel of the GNU/Linux system, was, as of a few months ago, covered by 286 different US patents. Each of these patents covers one idea used somewhere in Linux. Now, other estimates I saw recently said that Linux is 0.25% of the entire GNU/Linux system. So we could make a rough estimate that the whole system would be covered by around 100,000 different patents. That is, each of those patents would cover some idea used somewhere in the GNU/Linux system. That's a rough estimate. It wouldn't surprise me if it were only 30,000 or if it were as much as 300,000. It's a ridiculous system to cause trouble for software developers and users in this way. Software patents, software idea patents, create a new kind of bureaucracy that will tie up every business that uses software. This is why the European Confederation of Associations of Small and Medium-Sized Businesses is against software idea patents. They don't want this trouble. And every one of you should be saying you don't want this new kind of risk involved in developing software and using a computer. So get involved now. The fight is going on now, and we can win it. The fight is going on under the leadership of FFII, so look at FFII.org and get in touch with them and find out how you can help. We persuaded the European Parliament to vote a year ago against software idea patents. So don't think that this is a job so big that we can't come anywhere near winning it. We are within range of winning this. That doesn't mean we will inevitably win. We need your help now. So now it's time for me to invite those who want to support the FSF by buying something to come up and do so, and then I'll be going. So what time is it now?
It's 8:10.
So I have a little more time to be around, so I'll do that and have a little bit of time to talk with people, and then it's time for me to go.
There are Bob sessions now in room L. It's Bob sessions on Samba. In the room N, it's Bob sessions on Pure. Those Bob sessions are one Friday. Thank you.
Nee, ik was er laat.
Nou, file zeker. Ik hoorde het.